connected.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And today, in the UTC time zone, is the 2nd of April in the year 2022. Now, it's a curious thing, perhaps. I was listening to radio news or something the other day, and somebody was saying, well, you never can tell anymore. You know, you've got all these groups with names like, you know, Americans for Freedom and Puppies or whatever. You just don't know who's behind any message. And I said, you know, well, I'll tell you who's behind my message, right? This is not even difficult. I'll tell you who's behind my message. You know, A Step Farther Out is airing on AnonRadio.net. Anon Radio is supported by the SDF, Superdimension Fortress Public Access Unix System. All hail SMJ Ixer and the other folks who keep it running. Who is SDF supported by? Well, it's supported by me. I'm a member. I pay dues. It's supported by other dues-paying members, people who pay a little bit of money for voiceover IP or web hosting or domain name service or whatever, meta ARPA status, whatever that actually is. And who am I supported by? Well, mostly I'm supported by family and friends and people who send me money because they like what it is that I do. What else is there to say? That's pretty much the long and short of it. Yes, opponents of nuclear energy always like to claim that anybody who speaks in favor of nuclear energy is being paid off by somebody. Well, I'll tell you how true that is not. All right. At the beginning of the year, I wrote letters to several German nuclear power plants, ones that had just been closed, ones that were still open, saying, you know, you've got visitor centers. Can you just give me some of the exhibits from your visitor centers? You know, so that I can use them for various, you know, display purposes. And the responses that I got were along the lines of, our company does not take part in any public debate regarding nuclear power. Nuclear power is being phased out in Germany. We are not going to support you in any way, shape, or form. I actually kind of detest these people. You know, I see it in a sense as being their fault that I was spat on for carrying a pro-nuclear sign in a Fridays for Future rally in Munich. You know, they're the ones who stand to lose, perhaps not the most, but at least the most immediately, and they won't fight. Now, what else is there to say aside from, you know, that message of full disclosure there? Well, I'm happy to say that the other day I went to the thrift shop around the corner after picking up my dry cleaning, and I bought a couple of coffee mugs. Why did I buy coffee mugs? Well, because they were from the Wolf Creek Nuclear Power Station in Kansas. And they were both for the 1993 sixth refueling outage. Because, of course, light water reactors shut down for refueling and maintenance once every year, once every 18 months. They have to bring on a large temporary staff. They're actually people who go around the country doing refueling outages, and they do because the different your different power systems will shut down their power plants during whatever their lowest demand time of the year is, which in the northern states could be summer, in the middle states will be in spring and fall, and therefore there are people you can do three, four, five a year potentially and make your living that way. And there are people who do that. Anyway, so this was a couple of coffee mugs for that refueling outage, which I thought was kind of cool, and I paid 25 cents a piece for them, which I thought was even better. Definitely the cheapest I have paid for nuclear energy-related cups, plates, all those kind of commemorative items. So that was interesting. Also, I had another, I think I may have mentioned this, I had bought three Russian language USSR educational films, either about nuclear energy or with nuclear energy-related content, from a seller in Ukraine. He listed another one. I sent him a message on eBay saying, hey, can you even send anything? He said, yeah, I mean, I'm in Ivano-Frankivsk, which is in the western part of the country, and the Polish post office is handling things. And so I said, all right, and I bought it. And it actually did arrive, which I thought was pretty good. You know, it showed that it had gone through the mail depot in Lviv right about the same time as I heard a news story saying the airport there had been bombed by the Russians. But apparently it didn't touch the did not touch the mail. And then, let's see. What do we have other than that to say? So yeah, anyway, I sent off another nuclear energy film to be transferred. Again, those transfers are kind of expensive, but I do this for you. And if you choose to support me, I always appreciate that. This one's an English language film from the United States. Energy, the Nuclear Alternative. It's got some interesting stuff in it. It's got, among other things, Edward Teller appears talking up one of his pet ideas, which was building nuclear power stations underground. I've got more films, obviously. I've got some very good ones in French, and I got these ones in Russian also that I want to get transferred. And it's just going to be a case of when one comes back, send another one out. Now I've got bigger, more hard drive space, the uncompressed YUV AVI files for high-definition video are very large in their data requirements. So I actually had to get new hard drives to accommodate all of that. Anyway, so that's a brief précis of sort of what I've been doing the past little while. Don't think there's anything else very interesting to say at this moment. So, having got that out of the way, a while back I saw a really interesting film, and this was from the American Machine and Foundry Company. It had nothing to do with their nuclear energy business, but it was from the 1960s, and it showed how they had built a completely automated fast food kitchen. That basically they'd succeeded in building a burger kiosk, which only required one employee. You'd have somebody who took the orders, took the money, made change, punched the orders into the control panel, coded them for the automated system. And the automated system did everything else. You know, it would slice up the tomatoes and chop up the lettuce and make the hamburger patties and cook them and cut up the potatoes and fry the French fries and, you know, take the ice cream and make the milkshakes, all that kind of stuff done by machine without human contact. And I thought, that's really spectacular. Now, cooking is a difficult problem, for one thing, because ingredients generally don't come in a standardized format, right? Tomatoes are not all the exact same dimensions, right? Heads of lettuce, ditto. Potatoes, ditto, right? But, I mean, with 1960s technology, it was probably quite expensive and probably also a serious maintenance headache. On the other hand, a lot of the problems they would have encountered then could be much more easily solved now because computerized feedback controls are much cheaper and more accessible, so you can just have things set up so that they adjust for the different sized tomatoes and all that kind of thing. But it really made me think, because what you see today is exactly the opposite. That you have companies, you know, your McDonald's or what have you, wants you to order from a touch screen or order online, you know, some kind of computerized system. So the one place that you might actually want a human being, which is to say human interaction, right, taking orders, taking money, that kind of thing. Yeah, they want to make all that mechanical, but keep the people doing the back room work, the kitchen work. This strikes me as very strange. And it makes me ask, why? What sense does this make? In what context do we have to frame this for it to make sense? Now, I had this thought, and I'm going to share it with you, because that's what I do on this show. I mean, many people say, well, you know, you've got to have jobs, and I say, why? And people say, well, you know, people are dumb. And, of course, back in July of last year, actually, July 24th of 2021, I actually did a show in which I talked about the marching morons idea and why it is defeated, that people individually in the aggregate, yes, I said that, individually in the aggregate, people are getting smarter because, quite aside from heredity, you know, you're thinking of the, you know, Paranoia, Paranoia song, you know, the guy says, been around the world and seen that only stupid people are breeding. Well, quite aside from heredity, there's two very powerful determinants of intelligence in terms of brain development, and one of them is nutrition, prenatal, perinatal, and early childhood nutrition, particularly access to protein, and the other is stimulation. And so basically, between peanut butter and Sesame Street, we have greatly raised the brain development level of much of the world's population. That doesn't answer the question of why society seems to be stupider, right? How did we trade Walter Cronkite for Joe Rogan? Who's, I mean, I didn't really like Seth Rogan, but Joe Rogan is way worse. I don't know, I could be prejudiced against Seth Rogan. Most comedian people rub me the wrong way. But where was I going with? Oh, yes, this is where I was going with this. So we'll perhaps leave the question of why, if people individually in the aggregate are getting smarter all the time, why society seems to be getting dumber. It's a very interesting question. Is it just our perceptions, or is it something that's really happening? Is the level of dumbness of society a constant, and therefore it's shifting from, you know, the home to the political sphere? Again, interesting questions to examine, but that's not what I'm here for right at the moment. Instead, I really want you to think about the idea that there are two definitions of power. Right. What is power? Well, those of us who are technology-oriented, engineering and science-oriented, think of power in the terms of the ability to change the state of the external world. Right? So this is power in the sense of atomic power. Power in the sense of the power grid. Power in the sense of motive power. Power in the sense of all of those things, right? And power in that sense, right? It causes changes in the external world, which can be as small as flipping the state of a bistable electronic circuit, which is so small you can't see it with an optical microscope, or as large as, say, putting into motion a freight train, a 100-car string of 100-ton freight cars, right, 10,000 tons rolling down the rails at 100 kilometers an hour. All of that is power in what I will call the first sense for our present definition. The second sense of power is the ability to affect the actions and internal states of other human beings. This is the kind of power that Mao says grows out of the barrel of a gun. I'm not a big fan of Mao. But yeah, in a society which doesn't have a lot of power by the first definition, which is most human societies for most of human existence, power by the second definition is really, really important. But to a great extent, the more of power in that first sense that you have, the less important power in the second sense is. I'll give you an example from my own family history of Cyclone Willis up in Burke Burnett, Texas, back in 1930-odd, saying, "There goes Bob Carson messing with prophecy again," to which everyone said, "What?" And Willis, who was known as an atheist in his community, although I think it really just meant he didn't like the local minister, said, "Well, the scripture says two women shall be grinding at the mill. It doesn't say anything about a gas engine." Because my grandfather had put back into repair a gas engine that had been used to drive a machine for shucking corn and grinding corn. And while it was in disrepair, a couple of women around the farm had been using a hand crank to turn it. So this is a direct case in which the ability to influence the actions and internal states of others is made less important by the availability of motive power which can change the state of the external world. And here's the key, right? That our social institutions and social structures are all of them things which have evolved over long periods of time. Even things that seem quite new have a great deal of residue of things which have been around for a long time. And during most of that time, right, basically all of human history down to about the year 1700 and much further than that in most parts of the world, there has not been much of that power by the first definition, meaning that power by the second definition, the power to get people to do what you want to do, right, the power to get people to do what you want done has always been the most important kind of power. And so all of our social structures are oriented towards building up and rewarding people having to do with influencing the actions, attitudes, and internal states of others. You know, that's what we reward, that's what we prepare people for. And so I think a lot of what's going on in our world today can be interpreted from that viewpoint. Now, of course, if you're inclined to argue with me, I'm willing to listen to your argument. But I do feel as though this helps to explain some otherwise confusing phenomena that I've mentioned before, that politicians, for example, politicians like zero-sum games. You know, why is the membership of the U.S. House of Representatives capped at the same figure that it was when the population of the country was half what it is today. If the United States House of Representatives had the representation that's specified in the Constitution, basically one representative for every 30,000 people, it would have well over 10,000 members. That would certainly be unwieldy. But as it is, the British House of Commons has more members than the U.S. House of Representatives. Why? Well, I think to some extent it's because it's comfortable for the politicians to know there's a fixed number of seats and they just divide them up different ways, right? You know, that if your state's population increases, then it gets to steal a seat from somebody else's state. Every 10 years, they've got to reapportion the states, the seats among the states, and then each state draws its own districts, you know. So I think that that's comfortable for politicians. And so I would also expect a sort of zero-sum game economy, as it were. The highly labor-intensive world to appeal to them, because in a highly labor-intensive world, their specific skills are really important. The more power that people have access to, power in the first sense, the less important those skills of affecting people's minds, I don't necessarily want to say manipulating, but manipulating, influencing people, the less important those skills become. And nobody wants to feel less important, right? If you're in a business setting, you've probably encountered this as well, where managers call lots and lots of meetings which interfere with your ability to actually get something useful done if you're in the class of people who value that first definition of power. Why do they do this when supposedly, you know, managers are meant to keep the business running smoothly and make sure it, you know, makes the best results, but instead they really, really like to call meetings which stop you from doing the things you need to do for the business to get its business done. Why? Well, because it gives them an opportunity to exercise that second definition of power, which is what they're good at, what they're comfortable with. And so when I hear that the solar feed-in tariff in Britain was intended not to make any meaningful part of Britain's energy come from solar, because that's not feasible, but rather to get people to engage with their energy, what that sounds like to me is people trying to substitute the second definition of power for the first definition of power. When power comes from a power plant, you don't have to engage with it. You just live your life. You do your things, right? But people who are focused on that second definition of power, they don't feel good about that. Similarly, a few years ago at a conference, the head of Bloomberg New Energy Finance came out and said that high penetrations of renewable energy in the power grid system would require per appliance metering. In other words, you run your air conditioner when electricity is the cheapest. You can still run your, you know, you set your deep freeze so that it runs when the price is moderate, but not when the price is high. And you set your kidney dialysis machine so it runs no matter what the price is, even if it's $3 a kilowatt hour. And again, it seems to me, you know, aside from the fact that this would provide people who aren't you, people you don't know, right, possibly people that no one knows, hackers and that kind of thing, With lots and lots of information about how you live, you know, which is just, yay, more surveillance capitalism, exactly what the world needs today. Well, it does not sound, right? It does not sound to me like per-appliance metering is very liberating. Per-appliance metering sounds to me like a definite case of the second definition of power overtaking the first definition. I mean, you might not be inclined to agree with me, and you don't have to agree with me, right? I'm not going to force you to agree with me. I'm not going to demand that you agree with me. But I want you to think about the consequences and the implications of per-appliance metering of electricity. Because that sounds very much like a system of intense surveillance. And generally speaking, people don't propose intense surveillance unless they want to exert control over you. Power in the second sense. And so I continue to be concerned that, you know, again, one, I always say, when I say atomic power to the people, I really mean that, right? I really mean that. I believe that power in the first sense, right, motive power, the ability to make changes in the external world, is a very powerful is a vitally important, there's a phrase, vitally important liberating force. And if that's true, then we want more of it, more widely available, if we want to see freedom, justice, a society that's worth living in. And I think of this also in terms of economic and political systems. You know, today, profit-maximizing capitalism is basically the only model anybody talks about. But the regulated public utilities, which we used to have in a lot of places, which still exists some places, were a somewhat different model. They couldn't exactly be profit maximizing because in most cases their franchise limited the dividends they could pay, that they had to go in front of a board and justify their rates to the consumers. And there was always pressure to reduce costs to the consumer and to improve service and to extend service to more people. Think about that for a minute. I mean, I suppose, and getting back to the thing that I just got from Ukraine, right? You may remember that little cantrip about neither rain nor snow nor gloom of night shall stay these speedy messengers from their appointed rounds, which is a description by Herodotus of the messengers of the Persian emperor. Of course, those were not available to the general public. As I've probably mentioned before on this show, right, the concept of a public postal service only comes into existence by accident, because the Holy Roman Emperor owed a bunch of money to the Prince of Tarentasis and couldn't pay it back. So instead he gave the Prince of Tarentasis the control of the imperial posts, and the prince realized that he could actually make some money off of this by allowing wealthy merchants in the Low Countries to use his messengers, which were already carrying messengers, official messages for the emperor, to use his messengers to also send messages to their correspondents in Italy and vice versa. And that's how public utilities came about, that as a, it was never exactly, you know, profit-maximizing capitalism. Now, of course, the public utility model isn't perfect either, as witness the many nuclear power plant cancellations where the public utility commissions allowed the companies to recover the costs of unfinished nuclear power plants from ratepayers. Big mistake. But we ought to think of it as an alternative, right? We ought to realize there are many mixed and complex social and economic models. It's not all a single monolithic thing. Anyway, send your letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. You could send me money if you feel like it, paypal.me/PrometheusLives. And coming up next is the Dubious Goals.